Hi, welcome to the show. Cliff Goldstein here. During the fall, it was 1979. It was kind of under the looming shadow of my 24th birthday in Gainesville, Florida. It was just after sunset. I had a dramatic life-changing experience. I've talked about it before on the show here, but in essence, for 2.5 years I had been writing a novel. The book consumed me. The book controlled my life outside the pages more than I did the lives inside the pages. Then, to make a long story short, that evening, the Lord Jesus came to me in my room and said, Cliff, you've been playing with me long enough. If you want me tonight, burn the novel. Just like that. Now, this just didn't happen in a vacuum. There was some background to all this that led me to this point from being an agnostic to someone who believed, you know, there really was something else out there, even though I wasn't sure totally what. But at that moment, you can be sure that I was sure. Now, you see, because the problem was simple. I had to burn the book because the novel was my God. The Lord showed me that night that you shall have no other gods beside me, the true God. And that if I wanted the true God, this false one had to go, which I did, which it did. Now, eventually, though, you know, after a couple hours of some divine human wrestling and not knowing anything about salvation, nothing about the three angels and no idea of myself as a sinner. If you would have told me I was a sinner, I would have looked at you like you were a fool. But the bottom line is I took this manuscript, 2.5 years of my life, and when you're 23, 2.5 years is a long haul, and I stuck it on a small hut plate in my room and burned the novel, and that night I became a born-again believer in Jesus. Now, here's the thing. My experience that night was just that. An experience. It was personal. It was subjective. It was interior. I think anybody standing in the room probably wouldn't have had the hear the Lord talk to me. There was nothing logical. There was nothing scientific. Nothing from the common academic disciplines could have explained it. Maybe psychologists might have tried, but trust me, that means nothing to me. I know what happened to me that night. And what happened to me that night was mystical, it was supernatural, it was beyond rationality. Kind of like Saul's road trip to Damascus in Acts 9, 1 through 9. Read that again and tell me how logical, how rational, how scientific Paul's experience was. Anyway, the next day, what happened was, after that, I had my first Bible study ever in a health food store. And it was Daniel 2. And we went through the sequence of these kingdoms, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the breakup of Rome. And then when we came to the feet and the toes, and you know, the iron and the clay and the feet of the toes, and it said they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but not cleave one to another, even as iron doesn't mix with clay, symbolic for modern Europe. You know, I remember I burst into tears and I looked up at the people and I said, it's all true. It's all true. I mean, here, for the first time in my life, was powerful confirmation, not just for God, but for his foreknowledge and his sovereignty. Here, on these pages in front of me in that store, was logical, rational, objective evidence for belief. See, with Daniel 2, my experience of the night before was now underpinned by a platform that remains solid and as faith-affirming and as rational now to me as it was over 30 years ago. And that's what I want to look at today. Because, you know, experiences, however powerful that experience I had in that night was, experiences are just that, experiences. They're personal. They're unique to ourselves, and they tend to fade away. We as people, we tend to forget. And let me face it, too. Sometimes I don't have good spiritual experiences. Sometimes God doesn't seem close to me, seems far away. But see, here's the point. No matter how I feel, or even some of the bad experiences I might have, Daniel 2 is always there, never changing, and it's solid, logical, rational, objective reasons for belief that can be handy when at times when you don't necessarily feel full of faith. And that's what I want to look at now. So, you know, you think about, though, the book of Daniel. For starters, the narrative of Daniel 2 isn't exactly brimming with rationality, is it? If you remember the story, please, a king has a dream he can't remember. And so he demands that the wise men of the court not only tell him the dream, but interpret it for him. If they don't, they're going to have their limbs ripped off and their houses torn down. When they plead their inability, I mean, looking in sheep livers, which is what the ancient folks did back then, really isn't going to work this time. When they say they can't do it, he orders them all killed, including Daniel, who goes home, prays, is given the information in his night vision. Daniel then tells the king the dream, interprets it, and Daniel saves the day. Okay? Hardly the logic of geometry, to be sure. However, here's the point. Logic and reason exude from the prophecy itself. Think about it. How could a man living 500-600 years before Christ, even longer, I think, unfold the history of the world from his time up through ours were he not divinely inspired? Without supernatural intervention, how could he have gone through the ages, through millennia, depicting so accurately the rise and fall and breakup of those empires? Daniel, about 600 years before Christ, lays out the history of the world that comes after him. You got Babylon, you got Medo-Persia, you got Greece, you got Rome. You got the breakup of Rome into the divided nations of modern Europe today. Again, he was writing about 500-600 years before Christ. You know, we're not talking about some flighty ethereal phenomenon. You know, a few girls claim to have been visited by the Virgin Mary, or the magic goggles that Joseph Smith wore supposedly enabled him to translate the Book of Mormon. We're talking instead about a reality as firm, as public, and as unchanging as world history itself. I mean, think about it for a minute. We live here on this earth. We're stuck here. What firmer, broader, and more immutable foundation the history of the world could God have used to build us an edifice for faith? I mean, the history of the world. I mean, God could blow up the world tomorrow, but there'll have always been a Babylon, there'll have always been a Medo-Persia, there'll have always been a Greece, and there'll have always been a Rome. I mean, the foundation is rooted in the past, so really, even God can't change it. Now, the point is, this is what God has given us. This is the solid, rational foundation that he's given us in order for us to have a foundation for our faith. And it is powerful. Again, the history of the world. It's so powerful, in fact, that people try to find ways to get around it. I mean, the logic and reasonableness of Daniel 2, in which he tells the history of the world, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, the breakup of Rome, right up until our day. It's so powerful. It's so powerful that critics have been trying for centuries to find a way around it. I mean, if you don't believe in God, if you don't believe in the supernatural, or you don't want to believe in the God of the Bible, then you're going to have to come up with something to deal with this, because it represents on its face powerful logical evidence for the God of the Bible. You know, people try to come up, you know, there was a while back where somebody said that Moses was on drugs. That's how we got the Ten Commandments. And some folks have, you know what I'm saying? You, if you don't believe that there's a God, if you don't believe in the supernatural, you got this story, a guy going on a mountain, all this. So they said he was on drugs. And some folks have tried to find a way to explain Daniel 2 away as well. Because again, if you study it with an open mind, it's very, very powerful, logical, rational evidence for the existence of God and his way he and God's sovereignty over history. Now, probably through the years, the most entrenched attempt to debunk Daniel 2 remains, it's the so-called Maccabean hypothesis, which claims that the book of Daniel wasn't written when it said it was in the time of Nebuchadnezzar and so on, but it was written centuries later after the events themselves. This idea was first promulgated by a Neoplatonist philosopher named Porphyry, who lived from about 234 to 305 AD. And he argued that Daniel had been written in the 2nd century BC by Jews who were under siege from the Seleucid Greeks. And see, the sad thing is, and this is the amazing thing, that view today in affects almost all of Christendom. A majority of commentaries pick up almost any commentary, and they're going to have Daniel written in the 2nd century B.C. The book of Daniel, millions believe, was written around 167 to 164 B.C. during the Maccabean Revolt, which was these Jews revolting against Antiochus Epiphanes. And the defeat the Jews celebrate today with Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights. It's one of the few things that my family, we even came close to celebrating. Kids loved it, lots of presents and candy and so on and so forth. But the point in all this is that the history that Daniel wrote about, they said there's a Latin phrase for it, which, you know, vaticina ex eventu, which means written after the happening took place. In short, this is what you're dealing with. Though Daniel dates itself to the 7th and 6th centuries B.C., according to this theory, it was written hundreds of years later. And see, that's how they try to get around the problem. Well, it occurred after the things. Daniel wasn't back here telling about events in the future. He was writing after it happened, but just made it look like it was prophetic. Okay? Now, there have always been a number of problems with the Maccabean hypotheses. First of all, they said that they were used, Daniel used certain words that weren't around at the time Daniel said that he wrote it. You know, and that was one of the arguments, said, well, he couldn't have written it in the 7th, 6th century B.C. because those words didn't exist. Well, over time, archaeology showed they're wrong. Those words did exist. Supposedly, Daniel made the mistake in the name of one of the kings, you know, which would have been a common mistake had he lived hundreds of years later than when he said. But archaeology showed, what do you know? Daniel got the name of the king right. So that argument was deemed invalid. Then there was the problem of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and suddenly the Dead Sea Scrolls are dated just about the time that Daniel supposedly wrote it. They have a hard time. How could the book of Daniel be in the Dead Sea Scrolls? And even though they managed to squeeze it in time-wise, they had a very still hard time understanding how, if anything, the book could have become canonical in just a few years between supposedly when it was written, the Maccabean date, and the writing of the book of Daniel. Yes, not everybody, and there are other reasons too, not everybody has accepted this ridiculous Maccabean theory. But I'm going to argue that the prophecy itself helps debunk this entire notion. Let's assume for a minute that Daniel was written in the 160s B.C., okay? Let's just assume the Maccabean hypothesis is right. How could anyone living more than 150 years before the birth of Christ predict with such accuracy the dismantling of the Roman Empire into the smaller powers that the prophecy said would never cleave one to another, even as not iron is not mixed with clay? I mean, the European nations were fighting each other well into the 20th century. A measly 2 years before the Soviet Union collapsed, the world's greatest political scientists never saw it coming. And yet here was a man supposedly 160 years before Christ accurately depicting modern Europe today. How could he have done that? So you got to remember, the whole point of the Maccabean hypothesis was to deny predictive prophecy. The whole point was to deny the supernatural. And yet you see, Daniel 2's prophetic reach is so great, extending so far into the future, that it overwhelms this pathetic human attempt to nullify it. See, the hypothesis fails to denude the book of Daniel of the one thing it tried to denude it of, and that is the supernatural element in Daniel itself. Think about this too. Look at the power of the prophecy of Daniel. Look at the power here of that. Porphyry, writing in the 3rd century AD, was so scared of the book, so scared of the rational and logical evidence that it presented for the Bible, that he concocted this idea that was written hundreds of years later than it was when it said about itself. And Porphyry, though, remember, Porphyry, scared of it, he was scared of it 1,800 years ago. Now think about this. If 18 centuries ago, the power of Daniel's prophecies could cause this reaction, how much more powerful should the book thief be for us today? We who are living in a time when so much of the history that Daniel talked about had unfolded a lot more than in Porphyry's time. I mean, the book should be, and it is, that much more powerful for us today if we're open to it. Also, too, there's just a little point worth considering as you think about Daniel. If Daniel was so accurate about the future, you know, predicting events hundreds, thousands of years in advance, if he was so accurate about that, isn't it logical and reasonable to trust him on something so much easier than making predictions centuries in advance, and that is on the dates that he himself gave for the book? I mean, think about it. Now, there's more, too. The king's dream in chapter 2 was of a statue. As many of you know, world history symbolized in sculpture. The common interpretation is the gold head is Babylon, the silver and the arms and the breast, you know, Medo-Persia, the belly and the thighs, Greece, and the iron and the legs, pagan Rome, and the feet and the toes, part iron, part of clay, the divided nations of modern Europe. And this is not uniquely a Seventh-day Adventist interpretation. Millions of Christians and Jews have interpreted this way for centuries. Now, catch this point, because this is important. Unlike the first three kingdoms, whose metals stop after this demise, the iron of the fourth kingdom, the iron that starts in the leg, the iron goes all the way through the legs, it goes all the way into the feet and the toes, and it's there even if it's mixed with clay in the toes. In other words, the fourth kingdom, which arises after Greece, though changing form, extends to the end of the world. If you read the prophecy of Daniel, the iron that comes up in the legs goes all the way through into the end. Again, the gold in Babylon disappeared. The silver in Medo-Persia disappeared. The bronze in Greece all disappeared. Okay, but the iron that comes up after Greece comes up, extends all the way through until the end. Now, this is an important fact because this gives us an absolute identity as to who this power is. Because what world power arising after Greece, coming up after ancient Greece, extends to the time of the end? There's only one, and it's solely, totally, only Rome. What other possible power? You know, it arises after ancient Greece, which ends in the centuries before Christ and extends to the end of the world. Daniel, can you see what I'm saying? And Daniel 2 forms the basic prophetic outline for the rest of the chapters of Daniel. This is especially clear in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, which all but repeat the same sequence of Daniel 2. You got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. You know, you've got Babylon in Daniel 2. You've got Babylon in Daniel 7. You don't have Babylon in Daniel 8 because it was fading from the scene. Then you got Medo-Persia in Daniel 2, Medo-Persia in Daniel 7, Medo-Persia in Daniel 8. You got Greece in Daniel 2, Greece in Daniel 7, Greece in Daniel 8. And then in Daniel 2, you got Greece in Daniel 2. I mean, you got Rome in Daniel 2, Rome in Daniel 7, Rome in Daniel 8. In Daniel 7, the four kingdoms parallel the metals in Daniel 2. The fourth, and in that, the fourth beast, the one that arises after Greece, continues all the way to the end of time. The same thing in Daniel 8. You got the same thing. You got this fourth power, or this power that comes up after Greece. It goes all the way down until the end of time. So you got the same four powers, just more details are given. And as in Daniel 2, the iron, as in Daniel 2 with the iron, the fourth beast in Daniel 7, the last earthly power, it comes up after Greece and goes to the end of the world. Again, what power could that be but Rome? In Daniel 8, the same thing occurs. You got the sequence of powers. Babylon's not mentioned, but you got Medo-Persia, Greece, and then you got the power that arises after Greece, though changing somewhat of its characteristics, and I think that's symbolic of the transition from pagan to papal Rome, it comes up after Greece and endures to the end as well. So in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8, you have this sequence. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Again, it's important, here's the point. In all three chapters, don't miss this, the power that arises after Greece's fall in the centuries before Christ remains until the end of time. All the others, they vanish. They disappear. But this power that comes up after Greece, whether it's the iron in Daniel 2, the fourth beast in Daniel 7, the little horn in Daniel 8, it comes up after Greece and extends to the very end. And I ask you again, what is the only power that could be but Rome? Only one. Now, this identification becomes important, particularly today, because many people shy away from such a politically incorrect interpretation. It's not in our day and age of ecumenism. It's not the kind of thing we want to be saying. And then many others, blinded by current events, many have reinterpreted the chapter in light of these events, regardless of how those reinterprets contradict themselves. You know, I remember years ago, about 20 years ago, during the Cold War tensions, some Adventists, losing the sight of the big picture, argued that the prophecies we always interpreted as Rome weren't really Rome. They were to be filled by, believe it or not, Soviet communism. That was how they interpreted. Today, others falling into a similar trap are arguing that it's Islam, not Rome, which is the focus of these prophecies. Folks, the only problem with that is the text point neither to Islam or to Soviet communism for a lot of reasons. For starters, neither Islam or Soviet communism arose right after the downfall of ancient Greece. That instead, those prophecies point solely and totally and only to Rome. You can be as dogmatic about that as you need to be because it's as solid as the history of the world itself. Anyway, I don't really want to focus only on the past now, only on decayed and dead kingdoms, because the hope that the chapter presents for us is a future of hope. See, here's the thing. From us, for our perspective today, how Daniel handled what came before our time should get us to trust what he says about what's going to come after. And that's God's eternal kingdom, the one that Jesus bought for us with his blood. I mean, the statue of Daniel 2, symbolic of this world. Remember, it's going to be crushed by a stone cut out without hands. And nothing's going to be left of these worldly empires. This earth and all we know it, all its glories, it's all going to be gone. All that survives are those redeemed by the blood of Jesus, those covered and transformed by his righteousness, the righteousness of God, which is by faith to all who believe on Jesus. Now, think about this. Everything else is going to be like the chaff of the summer threshing floor. It's going to be blown away and no trace remains. Again, from our perspective today, we can look at this. We're here down at the end. Babylon came and went as predicted. Medo-Persia came and went as predicted. Greece came and went as predicted. Rome rising as predicted. Breaking up all as predicted. The only one from our time slot, from our historical perspective, that hasn't happened yet is the last one. He was right on the first four. He was right on Babylon, right on Medo-Persia, right on Greece, right on Rome. How silly not to trust him on the last one. Again, he was right 4 out of 5. We got such good odds for believing that Jesus will establish the final kingdom. As I said, Babylon, right, Medo-Persia, right, Greece, right, Rome. 4 out of 5. How silly not to believe him on the last one. But you know, there's even a better reason for trusting in the belief of the second coming and the establishment of God's kingdom. And that was Christ's first coming at the cross. Think about it. What good did Christ's death do for us on the cross if he doesn't come back at the second coming to get us? Can you see the point? Can you see the point? What good does it do for us? Jesus came, he lived, he suffered and died, and we still rot and we die in the ground like everybody else. As sure as I can be about what Christ did for me at his first coming, that's as sure as I can be that he will return. Because if he doesn't return, he wasted his time at the first coming. Yes, I do believe that Jesus is going to come back. And I admit, that is a faith statement. I admit it. But it's a faith statement that, with Daniel 2, is backed up with some very powerful and very logical evidence and reasons for it. Evidence that I say is as solid and as objective and as broad, as unmovable as the history of the world itself. I mean, how much firmer of a foundation could we have had, could God have given us to help us to trust and believe? Yes, I remember my first Bible study, Daniel 2. That was almost 30 years ago, which seems so far in the past. But what is it? But it's just a tiny breath amid the harsh winds of history as depicted by those medals in the prophecy. And what are those empires of gold and silver? What are they compared to this final kingdom? The kingdom we're told that shall never be destroyed, never be left unchanged to the end of time. You know, all these are going to be destroyed. And the good news about this is that we have good, solid, logical reasons. Daniel was right on Babylon, right on Medo-Persia, right on Greece, right on Rome. All we got is the last one. If you think about it, how irrational, how illogical to not trust him on the promise of the final one.